This is an interview with Angela Gelzer for the SEC Historical Society's Virtual Museum and Archive of the History of Financial Regulation. I am William Thomas. The date is October 17th, 2013, and we're in Washington, D.C. So thanks very much for agreeing to talk with us today. Usually we begin these interviews by doing a little bit of personal background, where you're from, if your parents had anything to do with the direction that you went in. Sometimes people talk about that, and then we move into your education.
Sure, I'd be happy to talk about that. I was born and raised in Providence, Rhode Island. Three of my grandparents were immigrants, and the fourth grandparent, my maternal grandmother, was the daughter of Irish immigrants. And neither of my parents, although they placed great value in education, was in a position to attend college. My mother's father died in the middle of the Depression, leaving her mother with five children. My father's family was a bit better off, but college was not an option for them. And I may be the only member of the one other cousin has a master's degree. One of the few members of the family to have gone on to higher education. Yes, my parents valued education. I think as the only girl among four children, I had three brothers. It probably wasn't until I hit my teens that they recognized that, well, she seems fairly bright, so let's let her go as far as she'd like to go, within limits. It's a funny, I like to tell people, my parents, my father said, and remember, Rhode Island's a very small state, and my father said I had to go to college and state. And, I don't come from a wealthy background. Providence College offered me a full merit scholarship, and that's where I went undergrad. And I had four great years there. And then when I applied to law school and was fortunate enough to get into some very good law schools and ended up attending Harvard, certainly my parents were very gung-ho that this was a terrific thing. And so it sounds a little hokey, but I feel like, grandchild of immigrants, and America does give you a lot of opportunities.
Yeah. You went into poli-sci, you were saying a minute ago?
I was a poli-sci major.
Yeah. Did you have an eye of going into law when you chose that?
I did, and it's hard. You know, it's funny, some of the choices you make in life, and this was a choice I thought of when I was about 16, and I, for the life of me, can't remember why I thought that would be such a good thing, except that I knew I enjoy writing, and I like analysis and figuring out the best way to make an argument, but I really honestly can't say that I had a very logical or pragmatic approach to, okay, how am I going to go about this? I think in any life, this is funny, Donald Trump says some things that are, not worth repeating or, kind of silly or foolish. But he said something once that I thought really was true, that to succeed in life, generally, you have to be pretty smart, and you have to work really hard, and but you also have to be lucky. And I feel that I've worked hard, but I also feel that at various stages, I was very lucky. I was very lucky that things worked out for me as they did.
So you finished at Providence College in 1977, and then you went directly on to Harvard. Could you tell me a little bit about Harvard Law at that time?
Well, this was right after the movie 1L had come out. I don't know if you remember that. You're pretty young, but at the time it was a movie, so you knew how close could it be to life, but about this first-year student at Harvard Law School and how the professors would call on you and humiliate you. And So I was very, very excited, but I was very nervous. And I think my first week, I had a headache the entire first week because the professors did, I don't know if they still do this, but at the time, I think every professor except one, Duncan Kennedy, a young professor, would call on you and would not take, I'm sorry, I didn't do the reading for an answer, or I don't know for an answer. You could be grilled, and it could be embarrassing for people at times. But it wasn't, like a lot of things in life, it wasn't as bad as you fear, and after a few weeks of getting into the rhythm of it, it was okay. I felt that I can do this. I'll be okay. And I remember the first time I was called on, just by happenstance, I was called on in two classes in a row. And so I felt like, okay, I got it over with that day. And I had answers I could give, and the professors weren't too awful to me. So, but it was a bit of a culture shock, I have to say, coming from... as I said, probably a lower middle class family, going to a Catholic, small Catholic college, and then suddenly finding yourself in Cambridge, where it really was a different world to me. But of course, it was a fantastic experience, and yeah. I'm certainly, if I had it to do over again, I'd go there again. It was a terrific education.
Did you have any notion of doing anything with securities at that time, or were you interested in any other kind of law?
It's funny, and I'm sure we'll get to where I was in the divisions I worked at the SEC later, which sort of ties to what I'm about to say. When I was in law school, and I was fortunate enough to have had Louis Loss for... securities regulation. He was quite a professor, but I thought the subject matter was pretty dull. And I would always say, I don't know what field I'll end up practicing in, but it won't be securities. I just think that is as dull as can be. I will not be a securities lawyer. And of course, as fate would have it, I'm spent almost my entire career as a securities lawyer.
So you went on to a law firm then immediately
yes.
after Harvard. Could you tell me a little bit about that, and what sort of work were you doing there?
When I got there, I was, well, first of all, it's sort of amusing, and leaving the name of the firm aside or the people involved aside, because this was, after all, 30-odd years ago. At the time, I thought, I want to be a tax lawyer. And I was told that the head of the tax practice group didn't want to work with female attorneys, so I would be placed somewhere else. And at the time, I know it seems incredible, I just, oh, okay, I accepted that. Hmm. And I was a little miffed. But I thought, oh, well, he's sort of an older man, and he was pretty elderly. He had a senior position at the IRS. But, okay, maybe that's the way the world is. And I worked for various partners. I didn't enjoy it. I didn't feel as if I was learning a particular skill in any particular area of the law. And although for a while I was doing food and drug work, which actually was pretty interesting, and after a while I felt, well, I could go here. I could kind of develop an expertise here if that's what I want. But I have to say I was not enchanted with law firm life. It wasn't for me. I know other people thrive on it. For me, it wasn't exciting. I wasn't excited going to work in the morning. It was a job. It was something I did, and I started to wonder, gee, maybe I made a mistake being a lawyer. I'm not really enjoying this. And then, do you want to hear how I got to the SEC?
Yeah, that was going to be my next question.
Yeah.
Spent about 3 years there.
Yes.
Yeah.
And I wasn't that crazy about it. Gee, I don't really like this. It seemed like a lot of drudgery, and, there were very few female lawyers. Also, it had gotten back to some of us that at least one of the partners, and I don't know that they all believed this, because I'd have to say, if you produce good work, people respect the work. And I don't ever feel that people would take a document I had prepared and thought, well, this can't be good because a woman wrote it. Never anything of that. But, someone reported to me, and at the time, so-and-so said, let's face it, they're just going to work here till, they have a husband who can afford the mortgage.
Yeah, it's fairly extraordinary. It's the sort of story you hear frequently about the 60s, but not so much the 80s.
Yeah, at the time it was enough to... It was irritating. It definitely was a little irritating. And in the beginning, they had their partnership meetings at the Metropolitan Club, which at the time women were not allowed to enter, but... Be that as it may, I think really it was more that I wasn't enjoying the kind of work I worked on.
What city were you in?
This was in D.C.
D.C., okay.
This was in D.C. And another associate, Jan Swenson, who I've lost touch with, but I don't know. But anyhow, she got a call from David Wesko, who was a young staff attorney at the SEC in the Office of General Counsel, and said, hey, do you know anyone who's looking to leave or looking for someone, to a few years out? They don't have to have any securities law experience. And so she came and mentioned it to me, and I thought, well, what the heck? I'll go talk to them. And I went over and interviewed with David Schwieso, who then was an assistant general counsel. And Diane Sanger was there, and Ann Schaefer. They were all assistant general counsels on the counseling side. I don't know if you're familiar with how the general counsel was structured then, and maybe now. There was counseling, which basically reviewed all the action items, like rulemaking and enforcement actions. It was like a checks and balances, another set of eyes to look at what a division was proposing the commission agreed to. And then there were the litigation side that handled appellate litigation and district court litigation. And so I spoke to David Schwieso and actually spoke to Wesko about, well, what's it really like here? Because he was a young lawyer. We were all in our mid-20s, I guess, well, almost late 20s by then. And he described it, and I thought, gee, I always said I wasn't going to be a securities lawyer, but this sounds pretty interesting. So I went to the SEC, and it was one of the wisest moves I ever made.
So you went into the general counsel's office then?
Mm-hmm.
Could you tell me a little bit about the sort of work that you were doing?
It was so interesting. And you have to remember, this was at a time, and I think the morale at the SEC suffered somewhat. How's that for an understatement? And in recent years. But this, I got to the SEC in April of 1983. The morale of the agency was so high. People were so energized. You just had this great sense of we're all a team, and aren't we lucky we work for the best of the independent agencies, and we're doing work to protect investors. And that sounds kind of corny, but the morale, it was infectious. It really was infectious. And I found myself involved in all kinds of interesting things. Every week there would be enforcement matters. So you know, you'd read the memo prepared by the Division of Enforcement and see if you agreed with their legal theories, and if they're, you might find yourself working on with the Office of Legislative Affairs on draft legislative language, or working with the division on reviewing proposed rulemaking. It just really ran the gamut. It was interesting, and you could have, unshackled by the billable hour, which, in my view, often creates this tension between the firm, you have to have lots of billable hours, but on any one matter, the client wants something done, and that can be a monkey on your back. And not that we didn't work under tremendous time pressure at times, and things had to be done quickly. Nonetheless, time was taken to think about what are the implications of what we're doing, and how will this affect other areas? And I loved that. That really appealed to me. And I remember within my first year, I honestly can't remember what the project was, but there was something that, you know, was a rush. And I had been there from like 8 in the morning till 9 at night. And when I was going home, I realized I was less tired after a 13-hour day at the SEC than I would have been after 8 hours in a law firm, which kind of was very telling to me.
Mm-hmm. So you were on the litigation side then, I take it?
No, counseling.
Oh, the counseling.
I was on the counseling side. So I would review, if Corp Fin had a rule. Of course, the different... I'm trying to remember. I believe at the time there were just 3 assistant general counsels in counseling: David Schuiso, Diane Sanger, and Ann Schaefer. And they each sort of would specialize in different areas, but there would be a fair amount of overlap, too. So it could be reviewing rulemaking from Corp Fin or market reg. I don't recall doing too much market reg, so that might have been something that was more handled by Ann Schaefer or Diane Sanger's group. Enforcement matters, legislation. Requests from Congress, which, you know, we took very seriously, and the Commission still does. So you gather the information, prepare a response to Congress. It would be a whole host of matters. Every day could be different. Or you could find yourself working on one big project for a chunk of time, but it was interesting, and I got to do what I really enjoy, which is a lot of writing and a lot of analysis of sitting back. Well, okay, this is what the rule says. Is that really what we want to accomplish? And, you know, that sort of analysis, which is, to me anyways, and I think to a lot of people, fascinating.
Yeah, it sounds as though there was quite a bit of interaction with the policy side of the SEC.
Yes.
Did you have much interaction with the level of the commissioners?
Not too much at that stage, because remember, I was an absolutely green staff attorney. But certainly, I would find myself in meetings. I can remember one meeting, the first meeting I was at, John Shadd was chairman when I first joined the commission, and he was quite a personality, very bright, very blunt. And I remember the first time I had to go to a meeting in his office, and frankly, I think I was petrified. And he asked me a question, and I don't think I impressed him very much with the answer, but some exposure to the commissioners.
Did priorities filter down then from the top level if what you were doing was sort of policy-oriented in some ways?
Sure.
Was that felt? precedent phrase it very well.
Yeah, explain what...
Well, basically, if you're dealing with matters that bear upon the overarching, you know, strategy of the commission, then that's set at a fairly high level.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So
absolutely.
Then if you didn't deal with them directly, then in some sense you must have had some sense of what that what the overarching strategy or policy was.
Oh, absolutely, because the chairman is in many ways then controlled the agenda. I mean, he only had one vote among five, but he had a great deal of influence over the agenda and the priorities of the commission. And that would in turn be communicated to the division directors, who knew what the chairman wanted. I will say my impression of John Shadd is that he was someone who could be persuaded, that he was not someone who said, well, this is what I want. I don't want to hear any discussion. My impression was that the division directors or anyone could persuade him that, okay, I see what you're saying. We will do that. And I know of one instance I remember where, as a very young staff attorney, I influenced a commission vote, and it made me feel really great because I felt very strongly about it.
Clearly, it's a better situation than the law firm that you were at. But could you tell me a little bit about the proportion of women that were there? You mentioned several who are immediately around you, and also, I guess, the comfort of the environment.
The environment there, it was, there were many women in senior positions. I think Barbara Thomas, just so I wouldn't forget or get my dates, there was a female. We had a woman on the commission then, Barbara Thomas. And there were women in senior positions. Just in the general counsel's office, Linda Feinberg, who now is a colleague of mine here at FINRA, was an associate general counsel. Elise Walter, lately a commissioner, was an associate general counsel. Kathy McGrath was the head of investment management. John Huber was head of Corp Fin then, but then Linda Quinn. I mean, there were women, lots of women in senior influential positions. Absolutely no sense that you were at a disadvantage or you were looked upon as somehow less than a male counterpart. Absolutely not.
Did you have any, role models, men or women, coming up at the SEC? Or we can apply that to your earlier time in law school as well, if you like. Or mentors might be a better word.
None that sticks out in my mind, but several along the way. Certainly, Linda Quinn gave me excellent advice. As you know, after I was only in the general counsel's office, I think, for about 14 months, and then I became legal counsel to one of the commissioners. And when that ended, I was trying to figure out what to do. And I'm probably getting ahead of myself, but I spoke to Linda Quinn, who by then I think was director of Corp Fin, and she said, gee, I'd love to have you in Corp Fin, but you know what you should do? You should talk to Kathy McGrath, and you should go to IM. And I said, IM? Why? Why IM? She said, mutual funds are taking off, and they're going to be more important in the years to come, and that is going to be a fantastic area. Which, remember when I had said before in law school, I said, I don't know what I want to do, but I'm never going to be a securities lawyer. So then I end up at the SEC liking it. When my first year at the SEC, I remember thinking, I might want to go to one of the divisions, but I don't think I'd want to go to IM. I don't know what they do there. And I ended up in IM. And Linda certainly was very helpful. And Kathy McGrath certainly was a mentor to me and someone I looked up to. And I sought her advice. She gave good advice. She certainly helped my career at various junctures, and was terrific. So I would mention those two.
Just to structure our mm-hmm. discussion a little bit, I only have down here that you were at the SEC from 83 to 91. You've mentioned you were at the general counsel's office, and then you were a legal counsel to one of the commissioners, but I don't have the structure beyond that.
When I got to, well, after I'd been at the commission for a little more than a year, a new commissioner, Charles Marinaccio, was coming. He was coming from the Hill. He had a very senior position on the Senate Banking Committee staff, I believe. And when new commissioners come on, it was the tradition then. I think now, I might be wrong about this. There may be more of a tendency to take more senior attorneys as legal assistants now. Maybe I'm wrong about that. But at the time, I was generally a pretty young lawyer with a couple of years' experience. And it was well known that those were fantastically interesting positions and that it was a great thing if you could get one. And so I interviewed with Lindy Marinaccio, and he offered me one of his slots, and I worked with Barry Melman, who I believe came from Corp Fin, and that was just terrific. I mean, there would literally be days I couldn't wait to get to work. And that's a pretty rare thing in life, even if you like your job, mm-hmm. because I knew there was going to be this really interesting commission closed meeting or a closed session, or you know, there was going to be this controversial vote, and it was, and you saw everything. You just saw everything that went before the commissioners, and you got a sense of how everything worked together and how the priorities were set. It was fascinating.
How long did you do that?
Until Lindy left, and he was filling out the term of someone else. So I think I may have only been a legal assistant for about 18 months
okay.
or so.
Gives us about the right time frame anyway.
Yeah.
So what were some of the issues that were going through then? It sounds very exciting, but please elaborate if you can.
Oh, this is awful. Now I'm going to draw a blank as to it was so fascinating. I seem to remember more of some of the things I was working on in IM.
Well, you can come back to it if you like.
Yeah, come back to that.
Yeah.
Because that was before the commission brought its insider trading action against Ivan Boesky in 86, by which time I already would have been an IM. So that, certainly there were some really interesting insider trading cases. There was, I pulled some things to jog my memory. I guess I have to say no one thing stands out in the time I served as legal assistant. I remember it all as one of the happiest times mm-hmm. of my professional life, that it was something new every day.
Yeah.
'Cause the commission then, you know, there'd be a closed commission meeting every week, often an open commission meeting every week, although maybe not that often, and there were just various matters, and the commissioners were all they had sharply different views on the appropriate scope of regulation and the role of government, but it was nonetheless very collegial for the most part. And so you'd be privy to their discussions and whether it be an enforcement action, rulemaking, litigation, proposed legislation. It was all very, very interesting.
Was Marinaccio one of the Democratic or Republican?
Yes, he was a Democrat.
Okay.
He's a Democrat.
Right. So why don't we talk then a little bit about... Oh, I did want to ask you, going back, that, of course, this period is known as a large period for corporate takeovers, for example. Mm-hmm. Did you ever have anything to do with that side of the affairs?
Yes, as you mentioned it, as a legal assistant, there were... that was an important issue that would come before the commission. And so, yes, you're correct. At that time, I would have spent a fair amount of my time working with Barry Melman, my counterpart, and with Lindy sorting through the initiatives. But my career ended up going off in another direction.
Right.
So.
Well, then why don't we talk about investment management a little bit? I gather that this is what your specialty was then moving forward. Maybe I'm wrong.
Yes, no, definitely. It became the area where I really my area of focus. And Linda was no fool. Linda Quinn has passed away. She is... I think revered by people who knew her. She was just tremendous. But I pulled some figures, and the number of active, these are from the SEC's annual report, number of active registered investment companies in the commission's fiscal year 81, there were 1,574. By 1991, when I left the commission, there were more than double that number. There were 3,660. And just to give you a sense of, I just pulled, how many are there now? I might not have the number, but I think they're well into the thousands. And in terms of assets under management, I think in 81, investment companies had $315 billion in assets under management. I think that number now is some over $14 trillion, if you count mutual funds, all sorts of mutual funds. And back in 81, maybe something like 3% of household assets would be held in mutual funds. I think that number is now closer to about 23%, if my figures are correct. Yeah, I believe that's from an Investment Company Institute report. So, you know, what accounts for that? Certainly one of the huge factors is the growth over time, as you're probably familiar with, so stop me. In our parents' generation, the typical pension was a defined benefit. Mm-hmm. And there's been a shift, gradual but relentless, to defined contribution plans, where the participant typically has a say in how their retirement assets are invested. So that certainly has been a huge factor fueling the growth of mutual funds. Unlike a defined benefit plan where you work for us for 30 years, we'll give you X amount a month till you die.
Right.
And it's all on the company. You have no say about how your money's invested. And there were recurring themes as mutual funds grew. It's funny, the world's changed so much when you think of high-frequency trading and dark pools and the globalization of the markets, but some issues remain. The issues we dealt with, and I spent a lot of my time there dealing with, mutual fund disclosure. I believe the commission adopted Form N1A in 1983, if I'm correct. And that was the first stab, and that split the mutual fund prospectus into the prospectus, statement of additional information, and then there's also a Part C, other information. Yeah, that was adopted in 83. But then there were very important reforms put in that I'm happy to say I was able to work on the fee table in 1988 that, for the first time, pulled together in one chart that an investor could easily read and understand what are all the fees that I'll pay. When I'm buying the fund, is there a front-end load? The annual expenses, you know, if there's a 12b-1 distribution fee, the management fee. In 1988 was also the year that we came up with the standardized method for the calculation of performance in mutual fund ads, which obviously is very important as more and more average Americans look to mutual funds. If you had ads quoting performance that were calculated in different ways, it wasn't an apples-to-apples comparison. So certainly disclosure, and that continued on. And I believe it was in 98 the commission adopted the risk-return summary, which is now part of the fee table, and the profile prospectus, which really never took off, I think primarily for liability purposes, because you couldn't incorporate the full prospectus into the profile. And it continues to this day. Just a few years ago, the commission did some more revamping of N1A to require everyone to include a summary at the beginning of the prospectus. Now, that sounds kind of dry as dust, but it really is an important thing for investors to have a way to get at information and to understand what they're buying, what they're investing in. I spent a fair amount of time on that. I was...
Common type person investor is becoming more involved in their investment decisions with 401ks and such. Was there a sense that there was a need to address the particular needs of that sort of investor? I know later on, of course, there's the plain language movement,
yeah.
But I don't know about that.
Yeah,
that time.
There was certainly a great deal of concern that investors were not as financially sophisticated as one would hope. My involvement mostly was in trying to ensure that whatever disclosure they received was as simple and as straightforward as possible. I can't speak to what investor education efforts the commission was involved in at that time. But it certainly was a concern that people need to understand what they're buying.
And did the market crash in 87 affect what you were doing there at all?
I remember that day. Certainly not me as much as the colleagues down the hall in Market Reg. I was in the chief counsel's office at that time, and I think that was the lion's share of the work done there, I think, was the general counsel's office and market regulation. But that was that, and it's, you know, for the internet, and there were some devices in Market Reg where people could, I don't even know what they were. I don't know that I'd ever been in the room. And you'd think the market dropped 500-something points. It was 25%. Can you imagine how people would react today if the market dropped 20? It was huge. It was huge.
It certainly showcases the vulnerability of defined contribution, or I don't want to mess up my terminology.
Of mutual funds.
Yeah,
of
mutual funds versus a pension, yeah.
Of any investment, right. Correct, but remember, if you have a defined benefit plan, then you're vulnerable to the stability of the company's ability to pay it. But that, of course, is governed by ERISA as our defined contribution plan. So, absolutely. The more responsibility a participant has for how his or her retirement assets are invested, the more vulnerability there is. And so the more concern there is to ensure that performance is presented accurately, that if a fund has very high fees, investors are aware of the effect of that over time, which is why when the fee table was adopted, it was also a little chart that showed the effect of those fees over time. But certainly market volatility is something that affects affects investors today. But the flip side is you want to educate investors and help them make choices that are best for them. You don't want to scare them away from the market. I mean, you don't. Unfortunately, I know a woman slightly who late 2008 just panicked and sold, after everything dropped, sold all her holdings. And I didn't know she had done it until afterwards, but, you know, you hate to see that happen because of course, you know, you had to kind of take a deep breath, and the market did rebound.
Right. So you were then at IM through the rest of your time at the SEC?
Yes. I was in IM. I was in the chief counsel's office, and then Kathy asked me to head up the Office of Variable Products, which I wasn't tremendously enthused about doing, but I did. I was only head of that office for about a year, 9 months of which I was pregnant with my first child. And when I came back from that position, from my maternity leave, I was senior counsel to the director, Kathy McGrath, and I was working, that's when I started working part-time. At first, 3 days, but then I easily bumped it up to 4 days. And then when my second child was due in late 91, I received an offer from the Investment Company Institute for a very good part-time position. And I thought, well, as much as I've loved it, I think it's time, and I left the commission then.
Okay. So then you're at the Investment Company Institute from 1991 to 1998.
Mm-hmm.
Was that all part-time, or was that, did you move back into?
Mostly part-time.
Yeah.
I think I was full-time briefly. That was mostly part-time, 4 days a week.
Okay. That's plenty of time, so why don't we talk about what you did there?
Well, I first started working with Kathy Herron, who did a lot of the ERISA-related work as they affect mutual funds, as we've discussed, and did some of the international work. There was an effort back then to allow for cross-border sales of mutual funds. It's extremely difficult. In fact, no fund other than Canadian funds that I'm aware of. There are a few Canadian funds that have been able to register under the Investment Company Act because Section 7D, I don't know, remember the exact language, basically requires that they to allow a foreign fund to register, that fund has to be subject to comparable protections under the law of its jurisdiction. And most foreign jurisdictions, at least at that time, the European ones we were talking to, they didn't prohibit affiliated transactions the way U.S. law does. But it was kind of interesting. We would meet with these foreign counterparts, and it was interesting. And I would get involved in some of the where the 40 Act and ERISA would meet. And then we developed more programs for investment company directors, and I became the vice president for investment company directors, and I sort of was also Matthew Fink's assistant. I would work with him on various matters.
What was his position?
He was president of the ICI.
Okay.
And actually, Matt was a mentor to me in a lot of ways at the time.
So what was your position? I don't think you defined
it. I started there as an associate general counsel, and then when I left, I was vice president.
Right.
So, I think I'm remembering that correctly. So, but those were good years, and I learned a lot about from the industry's perspective of how the rules affect them and what their concerns are, and more of the intricacies of back office operations and how things work. So it was good because I felt I left there both with an appreciation for the government's point of view, but then seeing things from the industry's point of view. But when you spend your formative years, as I did, at the SEC, you know, that kind of leaves you with a mindset that's kind of imprinted on you. So I think I've retained that to this day. I think I was at the ICI for 6 months or so before I stopped referring to the SEC as we. I finally said, "You work here now."
Were you involved then in liaising with the SEC or other SROs, or was
it primarily? Well, the ICI is not an SRO. It's
no, I know,
yeah,
I know.
It's a trade.
But I'm thinking like the NASD or something like that, because I know, of course, you end up here. But
sure, to some extent. Yeah. More with the SEC. You know, we would comment on proposed rules or, there was always some issue or suggesting a rule, that they adopt a rule in a certain area. But, there's a tremendous amount of interaction. There was, this is another example about how certain issues have been around forever. Back in the 1980s, it's been, there's been a lot of talk in recent years about whether there should be an independent regulatory organization, a self-regulatory organization, if you will, like FINRA for investment advisors, because investment advisors, the SEC, I think they can examine them only about once every 11 years. Between FINRA and the SEC, brokers, on average, I think it's more like every 2 years or something like that. This issue was around in the 1980s, and that was something else I worked on when I was in IM. I remember we were commenting on draft legislation, and it would periodically pop up while I was at the ICI. And so it's, again, one of those perennials that it's been a problem for the SEC, continues to be a problem, and no solution has really been agreed to.
Who are the people you would have been dealing with the most in that time? Was it was your job internal at the ICI, or I guess I'm still not quite wrapping my head around the exact nature of the work. I know you were doing a lot of interpretation of
On a day-to-day basis, I certainly would be working with the other lawyers, and the ICI is a fairly large organization. I don't know. If I had to guess, I would say maybe at the time it had 150. We'd be producing various publications, writing comment letters. So on a day-to-day basis, certainly most of it internal.
Right.
But, we had a board of governors that, after I'd been there for a while, Matt would have me attend executive committee meetings, certainly we would have meetings with the SEC staff on various matters, which would all become part of the public record, and so it was both internal and external.
Okay. You then went back to private law firms.
Yeah, I went
for a few years.
For a few years, and to work with Kathy McGrath, who was at Morgan Lewis and then went to Kroll and Mooring, and I followed her there. And again, I was practicing law, but this time on a part-time basis, which for me I found difficult to do. And again, after a while, thought I didn't learn my lesson the first time. Some people love private practice. Some people enjoy other lines of work, and I was thinking, well, what should I do next? And I was contacted by someone here at the then NASD, mm-hmm. who asked if I would be interested in coming over here, and I said, yeah, I think I would be, and it worked out.
So what position did you move into then at the NASD? Again, I don't really have details.
Yeah, sure. Let's see. I've always been in the Office of Investment Companies Regulation, which deals with broker-dealer sales practices. Remember, FINRA has jurisdiction over broker-dealers. We have no jurisdiction over investment advisors or investment companies. So I spend a lot of my time on broker-dealer, communications with the public. In the last couple of years, I've spent a tremendous amount of time on the implementation of Dodd-Frank, mm-hmm. the Jobs Act. So I haven't been totally focused on issues directly related to investment companies. It's been a broader scope than that.
Tell me a little bit about the environment here when you arrived. What circumstances, I guess, you've given me a little bit, but not too much detail on how you came to NASD. So can you narrate that a bit?
Sure. The NASD, when Clark Hooper was here, she approached me about taking on a job here, but it would have been a full-time job. And at the time, with my husband in private practice and two little girls, I felt the need to stay part-time. And so I didn't pursue that. But I recommended someone else who ended up getting the position, Tom Selman. And Tom is someone I knew a little at the SEC. I got to know better at the Investment Company Institute, and I know he's incredibly bright. He's got his head screwed on straight in terms of doing what's right for investors. I really think his judgment is excellent. And he called me one day and said, we're looking to hire someone, and I talked to, I'm going to back up a little bit. Mary Shapiro was then, Robert Glauber was CEO, but Mary had a very high position and the NASD, and I knew Mary from my days at the SEC somewhat. And I also knew Elise Walter, and she was here. And so there were a lot of people here who knew me, who were familiar with my work, and I think that made it a very comfortable fit.
Mm-hmm.
So it was, again, happy circumstances that having not been able, although this time I was able to come part-time,
mm-hmm.
so it was as a position of, what was I, counsel, I guess, just counsel. And then when I finally went full-time.
When was that? Don't worry.
It's been like maybe 4 years.
Okay.
I was promoted to being an officer. You know, they didn't have, and I think still don't have part-time officers. But again, if I know part of the overarching theme here is women in regulation. And,
yeah, I wanted to return to that.
Again, just a terrific atmosphere.
Mm-hmm.
And just no distinction
yeah.
between men and women. And
generally speaking, being in a part-time role in all this time was, I know it was difficult in some cases, but did you get a sense that even though you were there 4 days a week, that there was some mentality there that you weren't fully incorporated into things?
No, never in the sense that you're not dedicated to your work, or we can't count on you to get it done, because many a time I would come in on my day off. If something needed to be done, it has to get done. Never in that sense. But, you know, when you're part-time, you've got to accept the fact that certain promotions you either won't be able to take or they won't be offered to you. And that's, unfortunately, a fact of life. There are some positions, if you're in a supervisory role, where you need to be there 5 days a week. But never, ever in the sense that she's a part-timer, so somebody better really look over what she did. Never.
Right.
Never.
Okay. When you arrived here, were any of the disturbances from the 21A report still evident, or was it pretty much the reorganized organization by that time?
It was a reorganized organization by then, so
yeah.
I didn't.
Right.
That was not part of my experience.
Okay. So can you tell me a little bit more then, I guess, about some of the issues you would have been dealing with investment company regulation?
Oh, what have I been dealing with? It's it's certainly a lot. Dodd-Frank raised the issue, in fact, directed the SEC staff to produce two reports, which the staff did early in 2011, comparing broker-dealer regulation to investment advisor regulation. What are the gaps? Where should the regulation be harmonized? Where should the regulation be different? I certainly have spent a great deal of time in recent years on issues coming from that Dodd-Frank directive. The Dodd-Frank also gave the SEC authority to impose a uniform fiduciary standard on broker-dealers and investment advisors when they are providing personalized advice about securities, of course, to retail investors. FINRA supports that. So this sounds like that. Yeah, but tremendous amount of effort and work went into that, and you know, in trying to see when Congress enacted the Investment Advisors Act in 1940, broker-dealers and investment advisors, wasn't around in 1940, but this is what I'm told and what I read, fairly separate. over time, there's been a great deal of convergence. It's something like, I could get the exact figure for you, something like 88% of broker-dealer registered representatives are also investment advisor representatives, or at the flip, maybe it's 88% of IA reps are also broker-dealer reps. And there are a lot of firms that are duly registered as investment advisors and as broker-dealers. So, again, I'm an investor coming in. You know, what's best for me? A fee-based advisory account? A commission-based brokerage account? Do I understand the different disclosure that I'll get depending on which type of relationship I have or the standard of care? The SEC commissioned a huge study, the RAND study, found, I believe, most investors did not understand the distinction. I think it also found that most weren't terribly alarmed by not understanding the distinction, but they do, you know, in the end they are important. And I've spent a great deal of time on those sorts of issues. Jobs Act creates a new type of entity called a funding portal, which has to be a member of a National Securities Association. We're the only ones right now. So we'll have to, once the SEC publishes its rules, its proposed rules for funding portals, we will have to propose rules that dovetail, and certainly, obviously, our rules can't conflict with the SEC rules for funding portals, and I've spent a fair amount of my time on those. So you can see those aren't directly related to investment companies. In the meantime, issues pop up all the time. You know, bond funds that want to use some sort of average credit quality rating, and so, well, wait a minute, how are you going to account for your securities in your portfolio that are unrated, and closed-end funds. Some have a managed distribution policy where it's well disclosed that a portion of the distribution will be a return of capital. But what if they don't, and you come across a closed-end fund that is making a distribution, and it's not so clear that perhaps you're getting a return of your capital? That's something we would look into and provide guidance to firms about. And certainly in everyone's, not everyone, there's a concern that investors are chasing yield. So we put out notices to brokers reminding them, you know, in a high yield environment, if you're going to tout the potential for an investment to produce high yields, you've got to also make a balanced presentation of the risks that investment might entail. Because generally, you don't get the upside of potentially high yield without there being greater risk. And I don't know if that gives you some sense of the sorts of issues.
I think so. It raises the question for me, since you arrived in 2003, if there were similar issues of, I guess, corralling people in the wake of the Sarbanes-Oxley legislation. Or if that didn't affect things here as much?
When was Sarbanes-Oxley again?
I think 2001? It was 2002, I believe.
2002?
Because it was in the wake of Enron and all of that.
Right. Well, that would have been before I got here, since I got here in 2003. I don't remember that being such an... It certainly wasn't that something I wasn't involved in tremendously. But, and I should have this straight, there was some little glitch or gap in Sarbanes-Oxley that was fixed in recent years having to do with audits of broker-dealers. And I could get back to you on what that gap was. It's escaping my mind. But it's like some gap in the in the accounting board's authority was corrected. But again, I'm not sure how much I would have been involved. It would depend on the issue, because at that time my husband was a board member at the PCAOB. So, but no, I don't remember becoming involved in spending a lot of time on
SAR. Perspective.
Yeah.
So I'm just trying to evoke, you know, possibilities.
Yeah, no,
I don't know about the guts of the thing.
I don't think. Certainly Dodd-Frank and the Jobs Act. Mm-hmm. And I do feel strongly about the need to harmonize the standard of care for retail investors. And not that I think investment advisors and brokers need to be in. Again, I should say in all of this, these are my views, not
Absolutely.
Necessarily those of FINRA
Absolutely.
Or anyone, any colleague here. But I feel very strongly, and FINRA has spoken out in favor of the fiduciary standard, and I certainly hope progress can be made along those lines, and it'll be interesting to see what when and if the commission proposes a standard of care.
Mm-hmm. And on your end, were there any issues involved in the creation of FINRA from the NASD and NYSE regulation?
I wasn't involved in that.
No?
No, that would not have been. And I'm happy to say.
Right. So then the other question that I had is, I know that NASD and FINRA had quite a lot to do with the creation of electronic trading environments and monitoring them as well. Has that affected you in what you've had to do?
I am not directly involved in that side of FINRA's operation, so I would not be one to speak to about that. Certainly something I try to stay up on,
mm-hmm.
but that's not
right.
an area of responsibility for me.
Okay. And so I guess I should ask you if there's anything that we haven't touched on that we ought to.
I don't think so, but I just would like to emphasize, you know, and, you know, what a place mm-hmm. the SEC was when I was there. And I think it's still a tremendous agency, but I'm not there now mm-hmm. to experience it. It was a privilege to work there, and just the esprit de corps, the morale, the sense that we were doing God's work and making the world better for investors, it was terrific.
Mm-hmm.
It was terrific.
Yeah, I mean, you mentioned the great morale at the SEC, and of course, you know, the first decade or so of the 21st century has been a difficult time in the financial industry. How does that affect the atmosphere at a place like FINRA? I mean, does it allow you to, or give you a motivation to redouble efforts? Can it be difficult?
Redouble what sorts of efforts?
Oh, I don't know. I mean, because you have quite a lot on your plate, so to speak.
We have a lot on our plate. Mm-hmm. I think there's a great appreciation for how much the SEC has on its plate, and we understand if they can't get to something as quickly as they'd like to, but that's always mm-hmm. the way of the world. We're just all very busy.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a busy time, but it's interesting work, so it's...
Okay. Well, then, just to wrap up that, I think I'll return to that mm-hmm. theme of women in regulation. Of course, you've experienced the remnants of a more archaic era, and then you've experienced a very, you know, collegial, inclusive, well-proportioned environment at the SEC.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, we've spoken a little bit about women in high positions like Elise Walter and Mary Shapiro. I was wondering if you mm-hmm. had any further thoughts that you'd like to bring out.
My advice to young women now, to the extent I find myself talking to one, is to, I've spoken to women my age about this. women often, not always, in meetings, I notice this, I shouldn't speak in terms of always or often. I've spoken to women who recognize this trait in themselves. I recognize it in myself. Partner asks you a question. I would say, I'm pretty sure the answer is X, but I'd like to go and double check A, B, and C. Man would answer, the answer is X. And that, maybe it's my generation, that we had to remind ourselves, don't be tentative, speak your mind. And over the years I've learned that, and I wish I knew that going in, that and just to be not afraid to speak your opinions, that you probably know almost as much as anyone else in the room. And that's, I guess, looking back, the one thing I would change is to have more self-confidence and more willingness to state forcefully if I thought something was correct. Now, I am sometimes suspicious that people say the answer is absolutely Y when they're not sure the answer is Y, and I don't think that's such a smart thing to do. But I'd say over the years I've learned from observing people like Linda Quinn and Kathy McGrath and Mary Shapiro and Elise Walter and Linda Feinberg and others, that that's a good thing to do. And it's certainly worked to my advantage. There certainly have been meetings I can recall here where I stuck my neck out and said, okay, maybe everyone else in the room is going to disagree with me, but what about X? Aren't we forgetting X? Where maybe if I were 27, I would have been afraid to bring it up. Well, I must be wrong. No one else has thought of it. And everyone says, oh, geez, you're right. We forgot about X. You know?
Mm-hmm.
Maybe I'm not being fair to men, but or to women.
Yeah.
Maybe it was just me and some of the women I'm close to, but
it's an impression, it's your perspective, and
it's my perspective.
Yeah, that's but what this is all about.
Definitely, going to the SEC, not only did the SEC treat women terrifically, well, treated them no differently from male attorneys, taught me a specialty. It one of the greatest experiences of my life.
That sounds like a terrific place to wrap up.
And I mean that sincerely.
Thank you very much.
You're very welcome.